In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about recent events in South Asia and about the relationship between two countries, primarily Pakistan and India, to each other and also to the United States. And our guest for the program this morning is someone who has been studying and watching this region for a long time. Stephen Cohen is at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program. He's been there since 1998. Before that, he was professor of political science here at the University of Illinois and was one of the founders of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. At the moment, in addition to his work at Brookings, he is adjunct professor at Georgetown University. He's the author of several books on South Asia. One recent one that is published by Brookings is titled Emerging Power India. So if you're interested in reading about India, you can seek out that book. And as we talk this morning, if you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. All we ask is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and talk to as many people as possible. But anyone is welcome to join the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us if it would be a long-distance call. Use that number, and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Cohen, hello.
Good morning, David. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, it's good to talk with you once again. I guess the place to start would be with the relationship that in the region is the most problematic and perhaps the most pressing, and that is the relationship between India and Pakistan. This summer, in July, there was a summit involving the leaders of the two nations. The president of Pakistan went to India to meet with the prime minister there. This was the first such summit in 2 years, and the president Musharraf, president of Pakistan, was the first Pakistani leader to visit India in 6 years. A lot of people apparently felt that the fact that this meeting took place at all was significant. Before talking about what happened, maybe we can talk about what people hoped might happen before the as people talked about this summit before it took place.
Well, in both countries, the governments attempted to build the summit up as a significant and even historic event, and I think both of them made a mistake that they oversold what could be accomplished at a single summit meeting. There hadn't been much diplomatic preparation for the summit, and I do think the mere fact that the summit was held and that both sides agreed that Musharraf and Vajpayee would meet again and perhaps a third time, if not this year, then early next year, I think that's the most significant thing to come out of the meeting. It's been regarded as a great success by some people. It's been regarded as a great failure by others. I think it was both a success and a failure, and really made South Asia more interesting, perhaps more peaceful, but also more dangerous place than it had been before.
Mm. Mr. Vajpayee, the Indian Prime Minister, had some rather harsh things to say about President Musharraf after the meeting. Was that just something that was for internal political purposes in India?
I think in large part it must have been because he came under attack from the right wing of his own political party. And of course, he's the leader of the most conservative political party in India. And I think that's the equivalent of Reagan going to meet Gorbachev at Reykjavik and coming under attack from the real conservatives in the Republican Party. So I think he wanted to protect himself. In India, they're already beginning to look to the succession crisis when Vajpayee either resigns or becomes ill and is no longer prime minister. So I think part of what he said pertained to domestic Indian politics. He also threatened to resign, which is a tactic that Jawaharlal Nehru used and that other Indian politicians have used. And, of course, the party rallied around him immediately because they don't have anybody who can replace him at the moment.
Is the expectation, though, that the BJP would continue to be the party in control, or is there some sort of question that after Mr. Vajpayee's not around anymore, that might mean that the BJP wouldn't have the position of strength that it does now?
Well, they're facing elections in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is a state of 180 million people, and the BJP is concerned about holding on to power in that particular state. I think that the BJP could lose power quite easily in the next national election, not necessarily because Vajpayee isn't a candidate, but because the Congress Party, if the Congress Party puts together a coalition, it could displace the BJP. The BJP governs India in coalition with a number of other political parties. So in a sense, they govern at the pleasure of these other parties, most of them being state political parties who have no interest, who have much less interest in foreign policy than the BJP does.
The big issue that divides the two countries continues to be Kashmir. And in fact, as I have read about this, some people have suggested that until that is settled, there's almost nothing else to talk about. There's almost no point about in talking about anything else. Is that the way that people feel?
Well, I personally take a somewhat different approach. The central issue between India and Pakistan that you can put your finger on is Kashmir, clearly. Mm-hmm. This is something left over from partition. The Indians claim all of Kashmir. The Pakistanis would like to see a plebiscite or some kind of vote of the Kashmiris so that they could determine whether they would stay in India or go to Pakistan or perhaps become independent. But I think there's a deeper problem, and the problem is that the very identities of India and Pakistan are in conflict with each other and have been from day one. I've discussed this at greater length in my book, but I think that Kashmir is both a symptom of this and also a cause of the differences between India and Pakistan. Hmm. It's both a problem. It's a problem on many levels. It's very much like the status of Jerusalem between Israelis and Palestinians. It's not simply a territory, but it also symbolizes much larger historical and even civilizational differences between the two peoples.
Are there indeed that many differences, and is there any sort of a common ground that the two sides could find as a way of beginning to talk and perhaps move closer?
Well, the paradox is that Indians and Pakistanis, especially North Indians, have a lot in common with most Pakistanis. There's cultural similarities. Music is pretty much the same. Language is pretty much the same. They share several languages across the border. The analogy that I think is most suitable is when one branch of a family converts to another religion. And while they're still related, while they still remember close family ties and they have fond memories of family reunions and so forth, the religious differences between them or ideological differences between them really divide them and create enmities that weren't there before. So I think that Pakistanis and Indians, I'm speaking with a very great generalization, but at this level you have to, really have a lot in common, and they have enough in common so that they could live peacefully together with each other, but they also have significant differences, and I don't think that they can move towards a genuine, cordial, normal relationship until they do recognize these differences and find out ways of dealing with them.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Cohen. He is senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and was, before going to Washington, a professor of political science here at University of Illinois. And we're talking about South Asia, primarily Pakistan and India. This is his special area of focus. He's the author, by the way, of a recently published book entitled Emerging Power India, published by the Brookings Institution. So it's out there, and if you're interested in reading about the region, you can seek out that book. And questions are welcome as well if you'd like to call in here. The number, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Perhaps the thing that makes this relationship so critical, the fact that both India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons,
yeah.
People will recall back that in 1998, first India conducted some nuclear tests, then Pakistan did the same, giving real reason for concern, and also perhaps going back to the issue of Kashmir, because within fairly recent memory, India and Pakistan have fought three wars, two of them over Kashmir, and the concern is that a conflict between the two nations might well escalate to the point where it indeed involved nuclear weapons. What has happened, or has much of anything happened, involving the two sides talking about this most critical issue?
The nuclear issue is exactly one of those problems which demonstrates how the two countries have a lot in common but also have distanced themselves from each other. Clearly, the Pakistanis developed a nuclear program to deal with India. India has developed a nuclear weapons program to deal not only with Pakistan but with China, which it regards as its greatest strategic rival in the long term. And so India and Pakistan do have a common interest in seeing that their nuclear systems are not on hair trigger, that they don't plan a surprise attack against each other, that no accidental nuclear detonations go off. And of course, the United States has a very great concern in this, as do many other states. Yet they have been unable to discuss these issues. And at this summit, while the Pakistanis had it on the agenda, the Indians had it on the agenda, the Pakistanis insisted on Kashmir first. And that's been the problem of India-Pakistan dialogues in the past. The Pakistanis want to get to Kashmir. They argue once you begin to deal with Kashmir, then these other issues such as nuclear weapons, trade, investment, cultural exchanges, and so forth, they can be dealt with. The Indians want to deal with the other issues first and feel that Kashmir should be dealt with later on when relations between India and Pakistan develop further. It's a chicken and egg problem, and my own view is that they can't really get out of this themselves, that there has to be some outside power, particularly perhaps the United States, which would facilitate this or break up this logjam. There will be another summit. There are actually probably going to be two more summits possibly this year, and I'm afraid that unless they either prepare very carefully for these summits or some outside power or force or some outside country begins to take a more active role, that these summits will end in nothing. And you might then see the risks of war increasing substantially by late this fall or even this winter.
As far as third-party mediation is concerned, it's my understanding that the Pakistanis have been fairly receptive to that idea, but the Indians have not. They, Pakistanis, have felt that, as you suggest, that's what it's going to take to deal with the tensions between the two countries, particularly when it comes to Kashmir. But the Indians have said, no, this is between us. It's between India and Pakistan. It's nobody else's business. How does one get around this Indian position, apparently, that says that, you know, this is bilateral and it's nobody else's business but ours?
The Indian Constitution, in fact, has a provision which encourages the government of India to participate in mediatory activities. And India itself has done this in a number of cases with regard to other states. And the United States has played a role like this in South Asia between India and Pakistan. I don't think mediation is the correct word. It's a dirty word as far as New Delhi is concerned. But I do think facilitation, encouragement, quiet diplomacy, that kind of activity would be possible. And I think the Indian government would welcome it. They certainly welcomed the American role in 1990 when there was a major nuclear crisis between India and Pakistan. And they also welcomed a quiet American diplomacy in 1999 when they went to war in Kargil. The Pakistanis want the Americans in, not because they believe in mediation, but because they feel that they're so weak vis-a-vis India that they need a strong outside power in their camp to help counterbalance Indian power. If an American role were to be simply to support Pakistan, I think it wouldn't. I don't think it would go very far. We have to play a true role as an honest broker between the two states. One of the unusual things about this recent summit held in Agra was that there was no American diplomacy. We didn't have an ambassador either in Islamabad or in New Delhi because the ambassadors had just been appointed by the Bush administration and had not yet gone out to the region. I think the next summit we'll see probably more active American political and diplomatic role, but I think it would fail if it was seen publicly. The only way it can succeed if it's behind the scenes, quiet, and practically invisible to outsiders. That's because the Indians are very sensitive about the role of outsiders in these matters. But I've talked to enough Indian officials who would welcome a quiet, patient American role in a future dialogue with Pakistan.
Perhaps we might talk a moment about the relationship here now between the United States and these countries. And we do have a new administration, and so they're feeling their way along, as a new administration will. There is also, apparently has been some indication, at least from some of the things that I have read, that the United States might be thinking about lifting the sanctions that imposed against India after India conducted these nuclear tests in 1998. Apparently the Assistant Secretary of State on South Asian Affairs, Christina Rocha, has publicly talked about this. What can one say about what now this administration is thinking about in terms of policy in the region and specifically on this particular issue?
The Bush people are in the midst of a fairly large-scale policy review of South Asia. So far, they've been making policy on an ad hoc case-by-case basis. When the Indian Foreign Minister, Jaswant Singh, came to Washington, we tilted towards India. When the Pakistani Foreign Minister, Abdul Sattar, came to Washington, we had some words with him, but there's no consistent overarching policy. And I think one thing that Secretary Rocha will do when she returns to Washington, I think she's still traveling, will be to conclude this policy review. The problem is that there's some differences in the administration itself between those who would favor India, who see India as a balancer against China and who have no particular interest in Pakistan, and those who are very concerned about the India-Pakistan competition, would like to see America play a more active role. And finally, those who feel that India and Pakistan should still be punished because of their nuclear tests. And then when you bring in Congress, there's a range of opinion also. Many congressmen feel that lifting the sanctions would be a way of rewarding India and Pakistan. My own view is that the sanctions should go. We should extract some price from India and Pakistan for lifting them, but clearly they failed to deter India and Pakistan from testing, and they serve no useful purpose now.
The president of Pakistan, General Musharraf, took control in a military coup in October of 1999, and he has said that the country will return to democracy in stages. And again, according to some of the stuff that I've read, this goes back to last year, he had this plan where they would have district elections, provincial elections, general elections, and that was supposed to start this year. Has, in fact, there been any move to restoring a democratically elected government in Pakistan?
Yeah, I think that they've kept to their schedule. I was in Pakistan last December, and they had the first round of local district elections. Mm. Just recently, they had a third round, and they're electing officials, elected officials, appearing in some of the major cities. The elections are very carefully, I won't say controlled, but they're sort of guided by the military. They don't want people elected who would upset the apple cart, so to speak. And I think they will stick to their schedule of having national elections and the restoration of a civilian government in October of 2002. Whether you call it a democracy or not is another question, because clearly the military intend to stay around. They are not going to go back to the barracks. They're going to play some quasi-official role in the next government. And they've stated this time and time again, so there's certainly you won't have a complete restoration of democracy. But most Pakistanis, I think, don't want a complete restoration of the kind of democracy they've had for the past 10 years, where the political leaders were extraordinarily corrupt, where they pandered to the Islamists, where they raised Kashmir to an issue which got out of control. Pakistan did not do well by its two democratically elected prime ministers, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif. Hopefully, the army strategy is that a new generation of Pakistani politicians will emerge out of these elections. I'm afraid that they may be a little naive in that regard, and they may yet have to invite some of the old-time politicians back into politics. But it will be sort of a democracy. I put that in parentheses, or italic marks. And one thing you can say about the present military regime is that they have maintained freedom of speech in Pakistan. That has not been impinged on. The newspapers in Pakistan are very lively, and I think the military like it this way. The danger is that the Pakistani economy will further deteriorate, and domestic political conditions will be such that the army itself begins to lose control. Oh. Then Pakistan is up for grabs and could be a very serious problem, not only for Pakistan, but for all of Pakistan's neighbors, including India. I think the Indians would like to see a restoration of some kind of democracy, but they don't want to see Pakistan break up and fall into chaos, because then they themselves would be deeply threatened by a Pakistan that was in revolution.
How, perhaps you could talk a little bit more about how Pakistan has done the last, we're approaching 2 years since the General Musharraf took over, how the country has fared under his leadership, particularly in economically.
Well, as I've said, they've maintained a free press. In fact, the press is freer now under the military than it was under Nawaz Sharif, who was an elected democratic leader, because he was harassing and, in fact, beating up some prominent Pakistani journalists. The economy is the big problem. They've just been stagnating for the past 2 years. There's been no new significant investment in Pakistan. Pakistanis themselves have lost confidence in the economy. A lot of money is going out of the country. The one bright side here is that the IMF and the World Bank have provided Pakistan, they put Pakistan on life support, because none of the international institutions, including the United States, which has abstained on these votes, none of the international financial institutions can afford to see Pakistan collapse. That would be a catastrophe economically and also politically for all of South Asia, and I think it would impinge on the Middle East and Central Asia as well. In other regards, the government, the military government, has tried to introduce a series of structural economic reforms, and these take a long time to get moving. But this has been done at the direction and the behest of the World Bank and the Internet and the other IFIs, and the military has also frozen the defense budget, which is a good step, again at the request of the international lenders. So Pakistan is pretty much in the situation that a lot of other African and even Bangladesh countries like Bangladesh are in. That is, they must reform their economy, otherwise they stop getting international loans, and this, on balance, this is a good thing, because otherwise the political incentive to reform their economies was zero. So hopefully out of all of this you'll see a transformed Pakistani economy, because Pakistan could be a middle income country. It doesn't inherently have to be a poor and backward state. Hmm.
Just in what respect has the marginalization of the country as a result of the coup affected its economy and perhaps contributed to the state that it's in today?
I don't think it's been the coup that has marginalized Pakistan. It certainly put it in bad odor in Washington for reasons which still baffle me. Both the Clinton and the Bush administration seem to think that there's something evil about the Pakistani government. Certainly not a virtuous government, but they've put it in the category in some ways of Iran and Iraq. I don't think it falls in that category of state, or North Korea. I don't think it's that kind of state at all. What has dissuaded investors in Pakistan is something internal to Pakistan. Two things. One is corruption. The system is still very, very corrupt. And to do business in Pakistan, you have to pay enormous bribes. And Pakistan ranks at the very bottom of the list of all the world's countries in Transparency International's list of corrupt states. So, and the regime, this present government, knows that, and they're trying to do something to correct it. And they've arrested and jailed a number of people for economic corruption. The other thing that dissuades investors, and really is very, very troubling, is the internal civil war that's going on in Pakistan between religious groups. Pakistan is a Muslim country, but it's the scene of a civilizational conflict between Shias and Sunnis. These are the two major sects of Islam, or two branches of Islam. The Shias deriving most of their inspiration from Iran, and the Sunnis deriving much of their inspiration from the Saudis and from other Sunni countries. And there have been open warfare in the streets of Karachi, assassination attempts on leaders, successful assassinations of religious leaders, politicians, bureaucrats, and others. And this has nothing to do with the military regime, nothing to do with India, nothing to do with anything except a sectarian struggle between Sunnis and Shias, or radical Sunnis and Shias. And the military government is concerned about this. If they can't stop this, then the future of Pakistan is very, very much in question, because it's going to tear Pakistan apart.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Cohen. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. And before going to Brookings in 1998, he was professor of political science here at the University of Illinois and was one of the founders of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. If you're interested in reading about current Indian politics, you might look at his book, Emerging Power India. It's published by the Brookings Institution. We do have, I think, a couple of callers. I just hope people will be a little bit patient with us. I think we're having maybe a spot of trouble with our phone system a little bit earlier, but I think we've got that straightened out, and we'd be very happy to take calls. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone here in Peoria, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
The young people of India are trying to get out. There's 400 young people that are in computer division at Caterpillar. My daughter and her husband adopted two Indians. One was 4 and the other one was 6, a girl and a boy.
Well, Professor Cohen, do you think that there are a lot of young Indian people who are interested in getting out of India?
Well, a lot of young Indians are coming to the United States. They're also going to Japan, to Germany, to Europe, a number of other countries. It turns out that the Indian educational system has overproduced enormous a number of technically very competent young people whose skills are internationally marketable. And Washington, Austin, Silicon Valley, Illinois, parts of Illinois, have had a big influx of young, talented Indians, and I think we should be very pleased that they've come. But many of them who've stayed, many Indian Americans who've settled down here, in fact, have reinvested in India, and there are alumni associations sprung up in the United States of these very impressive schools, some of them modeled after the University of Illinois, in fact, which are trying to strengthen the Indian educational system, and many Indian Americans are investing back in India. And India itself is beginning to attract and hold a lot of these young, smart people who in previous generations were going abroad for employment. In fact, some Indians have come here, they've gotten work, they've done well, then they've moved back to India. And with the advent of the jumbo jet and cheap international airfares, it's possible to live, in a sense, two lives, one in India and one in the United States, and try and get the best of both worlds. I'm very pleased that Caterpillar has 400 Indians. If nothing else, it's probably improved the quality of food in the Peoria area. I hope there's an Indian restaurant that has sprung up.
One would think there'd have to be at least one.
No.
Let's go to Chicago for our next caller. This is
Hi.
Yes.
I guess the previous caller in your response preempted some of what I'm going to ask about, and that is what effect the training of these Indians in the technological areas, and computers in particular, are having on the politics within India, and via the United States and Pakistan. And is anything similar being done in Pakistan as far as training goes?
Yeah, Pakistan has lagged behind India. I hate to say this, but 10 years of democracy set Pakistan back 15 years in terms of its educational programs. It's just a tragedy as to what happened to some of the Pakistani universities. But Pakistan turns out to have a much higher literacy rate than anybody thought. And the increase in literacy in the past few years has been enormous in Pakistan. People are getting educated on their own. There's a much smaller but still active Pakistan community in the high-tech area. And I've met a couple of them in the United States, and they are very active in developing software and even hardware companies back in Pakistan. In fact, there's an interesting group called the Indus Group, and they consist of Indian Americans and Pakistani Americans who are in the software and computer business here. And they've joined together and they're seeding small companies in India, Pakistan, Malaysia, and other countries. I think Singapore as well. And they're investing in those countries to try and expand the technologies and the capabilities in some of those states. So you see a great growth of this transnational. I won't say charity because they're doing this for profit, but transnational high-tech activities that we've never seen in the past. And the invention of the internet and the Boeing Y jet really, I think, are the two great modern technology revolutions, as well as the transistor, which allow people to carry on these kinds of activities across borders.
In view of the large population in India, is this having any real effect?
Yeah, okay, I apologize. I didn't get you to the real, the important part of your question. I'd say two things about that. One, India has over half of the world's poorest people, and that's an appalling figure, but it's true. And India is going to have half of the world's poorest people for the indefinite future. There's no way around it. There are huge areas of India which are desperately poor, poorer than anything in Africa or much of Africa. It's really a shocking phenomenon. On the other hand, the number of those poorest people are diminishing. And the technology is being used in a number of Indian states. India consists of at least 24, 25 different states. A number of states have turned to technology as a way of resolving some traditional classic disputes. Land issues, for example, in rural India, are very, very central to the society. Who controls and who owns what land is very, very important. In a number of states, they've taken satellite photos, they've digitalized them, they put them on computer, and anybody can go to the district district office and find out exactly who owns what land. In a number of other states, they've taken satellite pictures to be able to determine who's encroaching on government property. So there is a clever and intelligent use of these kinds of technologies to improve the quality of Indian government. It may not directly reduce the number of poor people, but it's certainly going to improve the quality of life of the average Indian citizen where these technologies are successful.
There are a number of large Indian companies that are involved in this technology race, I guess. Tata is one of them, I guess. But are they doing anything internationally to affect conditions in any way?
Well, their international operations are primarily to make money. Tata has a huge office in the United States and provides a lot of computer and high technology consulting services to American companies. I think Tata is tied up with
a number of companies. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, thanks. I'm glad that we got to this because it's interested me that, and this, I suppose, is a flaw in the way that a lot of mainstream media, maybe not just even mainstream media organizations, report on other countries. They latch onto one thing. And then that becomes the story, and I think probably in a lot of people's minds, the story on India, it does have to do with the growth of high-tech industry and somehow this idea that Indians have an almost magical, supernatural ability
That's right.
when it comes to computers and software. And I think it's probably important to put that in some kind of context.
Yeah. The Indians will be exporting fairly soon, like $50 billion worth of software. The Chinese export $50 million worth of software, pardon me. The Chinese are going to be exporting 10 times that in hardware, but less in software. So India, while not a software superpower, is a significant player in software. But clearly, we've begun to replace the old stereotypes of the starving Indian, the Mother Teresa, the Gandhi, with new stereotypes of the Indian who can do everything. I don't believe in stereotypes, and I think I've tried to present in my book a net assessment of India, trying to evaluate both elements of India and come to some general conclusion. On balance, I come down on the positive side. I think that these positive, forward-looking areas are going to outweigh the negative. But I think it's dangerous if we ignore the fact of Indian poverty, still the role of the caste system in India, and so forth. And I think those will be with us and with Indians for many, many decades to come. But I have seen remarkable changes in India in the past 10 years, far more change than I'd seen in the previous 30 or 40 years that I've been going to India.
We have other callers here. They're local in Champaign. We'll go next to line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, hi. Professor Cohn, great analysis. And David, thanks for putting up this show. Maybe more are warranted. Professor Cohn, my question to you is, you seem to have suggested that the U.S. could play an honest broker role in the Pakistan-India relationship. What makes you think that U.S. can play an honest broker, seeing what U.S. Has been doing in the Middle East, quote-unquote, honest brokerage? And with the U.S. interest tied up with India on the financial and trading partnerships, how would that occur? And without taking into account the current United Nations regulations and rules which are in place since 1947 on the issue of Kashmir. I'll hang up and listen to you.
I think I've heard the comment before that the American role in the Middle East has not done much good. I would only ask, what would the Middle East look like if there were no American role? It might be that the United States can't bring peace to the Middle East, but certainly what the U.S. has done, I think, in the past 20 years is prevent war from occurring in the Middle East. Beyond that, you can wish for miracles, but you can't make them happen. In the case of South Asia, for many years, we were distrusted and disliked by the Indians. Clearly, the Indians were a very anti-American country for a whole range of reasons. I think the U.S.-Indian relationship has moved beyond that, and particularly our relationship with India in the last years of the Clinton administration was very good, and Clinton's trip to India really persuaded the Indians that we had no designs against India. And the Indians thought, in fact, that we were trying to encircle and weaken India. What's happened, though, in the process is that our relationship with Pakistan has deteriorated. This isn't because of any shift to India, it's because the strategic relationship between India, between Pakistan and the United States, really is running on empty. There's no particular strategic interest that we have in common, and America's relationship with Pakistan is seen entirely in a negative sense. You know, we're worried about Pakistani support for the Taliban, who in turn support terrorists like Osama bin Laden. We're worried about the Pakistani nuclear program. There's a whole range of negative aspects of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. My hope is that the Bush administration will move to alleviate some of this, and we'll again have a reasonable standing in Pakistan. We have a good position in India, and to some degree, we can serve as a quiet behind-the-scenes facilitator. When they can't get over the hump, when they run into a difficulty in negotiations or in some kind of dialogue, we will be there to assist them in one way or the other, perhaps by providing technology, perhaps by simply providing advice. Who knows? You can't predict these kinds of things in the future. But I do foresee this happening. If we don't do that, you know, if we accept the assumption that America could do no good in South Asia, then I'm afraid that India and Pakistan will continue to be attracted towards each other. They will repel each other, and since they both have nuclear weapons, I think we could look forward to a serious crisis in the region sometime in the future. I don't know when, but the hawks in both countries are trying to seek some kind of military revenge for past grievances, and I think that could lead to a very dangerous situation.
Again, another caller here. I think this is also Champagne. It's line 3. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for this topic. It is a very interesting topic. And I have some study about the relationship between India and Pakistan and Pakistan and United States in the past. United States used to favor Pakistan when India was pro-Russia. And India didn't trust the United States at that time. But since the fall of Russia, the United States have gone towards India, and they have withdrawn slowly from Pakistan. Pakistan has been unfortunate to have the politician, which was very corrupt for last couple of years. Not a couple of years, several years.
At least 10,
and
right?
And they have lost all of their, you know, strength in the past. The main problem, India and Pakistan have a lot in common. Their culture, their religion, their language, there are a lot in common. And they can do a lot good for each other if they want to. The Kashmir is the part of the problem, and then can be solved in peace if India let Kashmiris decide what they want. And the same thing in Jerusalem, if the people let them decide what they want and let them have their place, that will be solved. There is a lot of pressure from outside world, but nobody has done yet anything to help Kashmiri out in their problems.
Yeah, let me answer your comment. I think I certainly agree with much of what you said, but I think that pressure on India will not lead the Indians to allow the Kashmiris a plebiscite, which could lead to them joining Pakistan or becoming independent. I think that we can rule that out. There's virtually no Indian politician that I know of that would agree with that statement. And from an Indian perspective, since India controls Kashmir, or much of Kashmir, you have to take it seriously. From an Indian perspective, Kashmir is legally part of India. And a solution to Kashmir is going to have to find some way of dealing with that fact. Some kind of shared status, perhaps some kind of condominium status. Not quite sure. There are a number of proposals, but the Indians aren't simply going to turn Kashmir loose. The Pakistanis, by supporting separatists in Kashmir, in some cases terrorists in Kashmir, whether they're Kashmiris or outsiders, they've put themselves in a very vulnerable position because the Indians, I think, are primed to escalate. And if there should be another conflict, I think the Indians are primed to escalate. And furthermore, Pakistan is economically and politically a very weak state now. It's not a strong state. I think that the one point where I would disagree with you on your history is that there was a period when the United States and India were very, very close, and that's when China and India went to war in 1962. Then America supplied India with a huge amount of grant military assistance, and that in turn led to the Pakistanis turning to China. And there have been these strategic alignments and realignments for the past 40 years. I think we're in the. I think we're through with much of that now. I don't think the U.S.-India relationship will lead to an alliance, but clearly it's close enough so that we can talk with the Indians and work with the Indians on such issues as Kashmir, and hopefully we'll restore our relationship with Pakistan. But I don't think we should do much more than serve as an outside facilitator. I don't think we should get in and attempt to pressure either country into a particular policy.
Just one point. It seems, from what I've read about this, there is one thing perhaps that Pakistan and India would agree on as far as Kashmir is concerned, and that is neither of those countries wants to see an independent Kashmir.
That's right. That's certainly right. The interesting thing about Kashmir is that it's been very widely debated in India. It has not been widely debated in Pakistan. I think in the next few years we're going to see a much broader Pakistani debate about different solutions or different settlements of Kashmir, as we have seen in India. And I think the Musharraf government is to be praised for allowing that kind of discussion to go forth in the Pakistani press.
We have 7-8 minutes left, perhaps, in this part of Focus
Today. Okay,
sure. And I also would like to tell people who are listening that our guest is Stephen Cohen. He's a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. And questions are welcome. We're talking about South Asia. Primarily here we're talking about India and Pakistan. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. In July, I think roughly about the same time that the summit was going on involving Presidents Vajpayee and Musharraf, the president of China, Jiang Zemin, was in Moscow. And he and President Putin signed a friendship pact, quote-unquote friendship pact, involving Russia and China. This relationship between China and Russia, is that something that concerns Indians?
No, they've got a friendship pact with the Russians themselves. They've got a working relationship with China, even though they still have a big border dispute. They've declared that we, the United States and India, are natural allies. What you see now evolving in this post-Cold War world is China, Russia, the United States, Japan, and India being the great players in Asia. These are the five major Asian states. I hope I've added them up right. You know, and they're going to work with each other. They're going to oppose each other. None wants to have the other as a strong enemy. They will use countries such as Pakistan to undercut the other or to support the other, the way the Chinese support Pakistan against India. The Indians are moving to Southeast Asia to balance out the Chinese, yet there's no direct hostility between India and China. I think you're going to see this kind of dance going on indefinitely. It's very much like the old balance of power game that we saw in 19th century Europe, where the major powers adjust and readjust. The one difference is that since they're all nuclear powers, they cannot have a war with each other. And I think that's perhaps one good aspect of being a nuclear power. It's too dangerous to contemplate a real war with another major power.
We have other callers. Next is line one. This is Champagne. Hello.
I believe that I've read that since India and Pakistan carried out their nuclear tests, that, showing unusual good sense, they haven't actually taken steps to deploy any nuclear weapons. Is that correct?
We hope it's correct. If you know more about that than I do, please let me know. Besides my book, another book has been published by a RAND Corporation expert named Ashley Tellis, which is the definitive study of the Indian nuclear program. And he also says that they probably haven't deployed. There could be secret deployment that we don't know about, but I suspect that's probably not occurred. And it is in America's interest, and I think in their interest, that they not deploy. And I think they should be encouraged and rewarded, in fact, by not deploying their nuclear weapons. I think that our policy of making faces at them and of sanctioning them because of the nuclear program has to come to an end. And I would go so far as to favor the sale of civilian nuclear reactors under suitable inspection as a reward or in exchange for them not becoming active deployed nuclear weapon states.
I would agree with all that. I would hope that we could do something with windmills or something like that rather.
Well, yeah. Department of Energy does have a program in India, had a program in India about non-nuclear energy sources. I think we should be pouring a lot more money into that. I agree with you. I think that makes economic sense. It also makes good strategic and political sense.
Thanks a lot.
All right, let's go to Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Hi, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a question. Like, right before independence of India, Pakistan was the part of India. India is considered one of the largest democracies in the world, whereas the democracy has never worked in Pakistan. What could be the precise reason for that? And my question is with regard to Kashmir. If when we have this kind of problem in one place, democracy working for the several years and several centuries, the other place, the age of the country is nearly 50 years and democracy has never worked. Do we see a solution for Kashmir?
Yeah, let me deal. You've asked many questions, and they would take, I think, 4 more hours to do it. I'd be happy to come back and go on. But let me say this briefly, that India is not quite the democracy that its wildly enthusiastic supporters claim it to be. There's a lot of caste discrimination in India. There are parts of India which are basically under martial law. Kashmir itself is a free fire zone. There are big chunks, holes in the Indian democracy. But India is the world's largest democracy, but still it's not. No democracy is perfect. It has its imperfections. In the case of Pakistan, it's not quite the military dictatorship that some portray it. Pakistanis would like to be a democracy. They would like to have a democracy. They don't have elections all the time, but by and large, it's a fairly free and open state, and they envy India. They would like to have something the way, like the Indians have. So I think the two countries in this respect are actually closer than they appear to be. And labeling them one as a democracy and the other as a dictatorship is not quite accurate.
Okay, so but in this regard, do you see a solution to the problem of Kashmir in the near future?
No, I don't see a solution to the problem of Kashmir in the near future because it's going to take another decade or two. I see the recent summit as simply stage two of perhaps what might be a 100-stage process. And I think the most important thing to bear in mind is that a process of dialogue between India and Pakistan has begun. I think it actually began last December when the Indians made some steps and the Pakistanis reciprocated. And this summit is simply an extension of that. We'll see more meetings. Some will be successes. Some will be failures. I think it's important to keep them talking and to take steps which will prevent them from shooting. And here I think the U.S. can play a marginal but useful role.
We'll try and get at least one more caller here. We'll go to Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Forgive me if I'm repeating something I missed in the first 10 minutes of the show, but I would like to know what your take is on India's pretty quick support for the missile defense program of the new Bush administration.
Well, yeah. You know, I haven't talked about that. I think it was very interesting development. They appear to have supported the Bush missile defense program, and they certainly praised the Bush decision to cut our nuclear weapons. In fact, in subsequent statements after they made the initial statement, they backed away very far from what they had said originally. So they're now back where they were before, not opposing missile defense, but certainly not in support of it. They have stuck to the original position. Because it had been their position all along that the world should get rid of nuclear weapons. So I think the Indian diplomacy was seen in Washington as very, very pro-American, but in fact, in subsequent weeks, they qualified that considerably. And this was in part, it's my understanding, part of bureaucratic politics within India. They took a position that was quite different, then they backed away from it as the bureaucracy and others asserted themselves.
We will have to stop at this point because we have used our time. There's certainly more we could talk about, perhaps on another day we could visit again. But for the moment, we'll say to our guest, Stephen Cohen, thanks very much for your time.
Well, David, I really appreciate it. You know, I spent 34 years in Urbana. I still listen to WILL when I can. I think you've got a great program, and I'm very, very happy to appear this time, and certainly anytime you want, be happy to come back.
Very good.
In fact, I'm working on a book on Pakistan, and perhaps when that's done, we can have me back.
Excellent.
And we can talk about
excellent.
Pakistan.
We'll certainly would do that. Okay. Our guest, Stephen Cohen, he is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and if you're interested in reading some of his writing on India, there's a recently published book published by Brookings that's entitled Emerging Power India. And so you can look for that.